move to our merit panels, and are the parties ready in the Delanoy case? Mr. Smith and Mr. Frazen?
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Regosta? Or did I mispronounce? Good morning.
Good morning.
Again, I will remind everyone, we probably have everyone from our morning docket here, but please, either before you begin or after you conclude, please endorse the sign-up sheet so that we can be sure to get your names properly affixed. Thank you. And do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor, wish to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Okay. Just one moment. Excuse me, go right ahead.
So may it please the court, my name is Christopher Smith, I represent the husband, Charles Delanoy, in this matter. And there are, basically I wanted to use my time today to focus on three of the several, of the various issues, but there are three main points of which we're alleging error or abuse of discretion. One, we're alleging that the trial court erred and abused its discretion in failing to find adultery in this case, and the overwhelming evidence of it. Two, the issue where the court went ahead and found that Mr. Delanoy had gifted the Merritt, Michigan property, or the three-quarters interest, to the wife, even though the trial court found that he had successfully traced it back. The trial court then said, well, there was evidence of gift, and we allege that, obviously, the law says you have to have clear and convincing evidence of a gift. There's no mention of clear and convincing even to begin with. There's no evidence of any donative intent. The trial court simply said, well, you all used it for a vacation home, so that's good enough. We're going to jump the hoop and find it a gift. And then the other third issue, which I think we should focus on, is the issue of lump sum. This is a case in which the trial court awarded the wife a lump sum of $300,000. The case law talks about you need to, if you're going to do that, you need to find special, special circumstances or compelling reasons to do so. This is not a case, the wife cited the case of Gottlieb, in which there was a $600,000, which is a dollar lump sum.
Can I interrupt you one second, because your time goes by so fast. I have one question on one of the other assignments of error,
certainly,
and then let you get back to that. On, I think it was your fourth assignment of error, this is the one where the $300,000 was withdrawn by the wife in like May of 2012, the spring of, 2010. And that money was then put into a separate account for her. Then the husband withdrew approximately $687,000, almost $700,000. And you are urging us to reverse the circuit court with regard to the classification of account 7053 that the husband set up, if I remember correctly.
Right. So on the $300,000 that the wife withdrew without...
So my question basically is this. If we were to reverse and instruct the trial court to retrace with regard to that nearly $700,000, this had all been in account 4959. If we were to agree with your argument on that and ask the trial court to retrace and remanding, why wouldn't we have to also ask the trial court to, on the account 50532 that the trial court found was separate property for your client, and Mrs. Delanoy says that needs to be reversed. Why wouldn't we need to also reverse and remand to the trial court on that one and ask for retracing there?
Well, so certainly the issue of tracing is one for the fact finder, and my apologies to the court for the extent of the appendix and the volumes, but part of the reason for that is because this was such a document-intensive case. From the husband's point of view, we had all of the various bank statements for all the years, all the transactions from one account to the other, and those were so the trial court had ample evidence as to where the money went. The $300,000, that argument was the money from there. One was we took a position that it was separate because the husband had some stock that was sold, and the proceeds from that were funding, and so that was one of the arguments.
Well, there was $200,000 he did with the Klockner stock, if I'm pronouncing that right,
Klockner,
in 2006, mm-hmm. And that was he argues, you argue, is completely traceable and his separate property. But there was $800,000 from a Klockner stock deal from 2003, which he says he really can't, or it wasn't clear to me that you could trace it. And so if the $200,000 is his separate property, but the $800,000 has been commingled, or one can't say that it's anything but marital, why wouldn't everything that came out of that account 4959, where that essentially was the $1 million from those two stock deals,
right,
why wouldn't that have to be retraceable for both the part, the $300,000 that wife took out and the nearly $700,000 that husband took out?
Well, we took the, there was very specific evidence put forth at the trial on the calculations of how the husband figured out what portion was separate and what portion was marital and what portion came from funds earned post-separation and so forth. And all of those calculations were put in, and the evidence and the supporting documentation were put in multiple times to the court. Now, I mean, certainly there are, there are many issues that we talk about in terms of tracing issues. There's the waste issue, for example, where the court, both parties talk about.
Right. That's a separate assignment of error.
Right.
But on this, he says, and I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but he said, look, I did some, you know, I looked at this, I looked at my post-separation paychecks and bonuses,
right,
and when I took the funds out of 7053 and put it in, I don't have in front of me the other account number that is pretty much conceded to be marital, but he said there's approximately 400,000 of that, originally 300, but it grew to 400 by the hearing date, I believe, and that was separate. And the other part of that, approximately 700,000, was marital, and he conceded that was marital. How do we know that, though, without retracing?
Well,
follow
the,
that.
So the husband had various inheritance, and there was a reference in the briefs about the INHDSE, which stands for inheritance, and drugstore. And those were two
right.
big sources. And there were accounts that were set up to segregate those funds. And
but that didn't go into these two accounts.
No, well, the stock that was purchased came from this separate money, and then the stock that was sold is funding some of these accounts. And so that was one of our claims that we made to the trial judge and said, number one, we take the position that the money that she withdrew is separate. Now, she didn't agree with us on that, but she kind of went a different route and looked at the calculations when we showed where the money had come from and what he had gone ahead and earned since, and she had the documentation, and she made those findings. I mean, certainly, wife takes the position that, you know, there were issues where the court came back and said that we had successfully traced, like on 053, 100% separate, and they take the position, know that the trial judge was error in doing so. I mean, volume upon volume of volume of bank documents. I mean, it is a very complex case, and so I apologize for the extent of the appendix, but that was part of the reason.
I don't want to use all your time up answering my question, but I just had that question about, for the approximately $1 million in the 4959
right.
account, why, if only 200,000 of that was traceable to his separate property, how can we know that what went into his separate account and what went in, I mean, the account in his name and then what the account that went in her name, why didn't it all have to be retraced?
Well, and our position is that it was all retraced, and that if there was calculations in the appendix, there's the post-trial memo, there's the motion to reconsider, and these other briefs we've referenced where we have the documentation where we do all the calculations and break it out, and it's all laid forth. It was laid forth in front of the trial judge.
I don't
want
to take you off your other assignments.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Because it's a big item, though, that $1 million. So.
It was, and that leads us to one of the arguments that the wife went ahead and spent the full $300,000, indicated that she intended to do so. The court found that $74,000 or so was waste. The other side says, well, maybe $18,000 at most, but can't be that much. But we agree that neither of us know how we got to that point. But I wanted the main issue is where we think the greatest abuse was is basically the wife takes the position that unless she and the paramour acknowledged that we had sexual relations, but for that acknowledgement, you can't make a finding of adultery. And so this is a case where this, the evidence was overwhelming with the extent of the involvement. The paramour, Mr. Lipton, continued to be involved in the proceedings up until, and he was present on the final day almost 2 years later. There were court orders that talked about his involvement with restrictions. These people didn't hide the realities. They didn't acknowledge the romantic relationship. They acknowledged sleeping together, naked, physical attraction, touching, and whatnot. And
can I ask you on that?
Sure.
Judge Higgins, though, as the fact finder,
yes,
said she believed them when they said, yes, we slept together numerous times, we were attracted to each other, romantically involved, but we never committed adultery. And she believed them. Where does that leave us as an appellate court?
Well, and as appellate court, that's where we're alleging abuse of discretion, because
that she was just plainly wrong in saying, if you've slept together that many times and you admit that you're romantically involved, that adultery didn't happen.
Right. I mean, and there's, as I've set forth in my brief, there's ample appellate authority where this court has said to the trial court, you were wrong to not find adultery. It doesn't have to be proven by beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have to hit us over the head. I mean, the record here is so farther additional with evidence of their involvement than in a typical case. And then the lump sum of $300,000, she hangs her hat. There's a line or two about, well, she needs to buy a house. Well, by the time the final order has been entered, this woman has already bought a house. She's had a free education paid for at nursing school through JMU from the husband. She doesn't have student loan. She has a house. And there's no special, her health is fine. There's no evidence of special need or special or compelling circumstances. And then it's a $300,000, here you go, without a full explanation of the factors. And it doesn't really explain how we got there. And basically, I mean, I don't think it's the intent of this court. I mean, periodic defined duration, if there is going to be spouse support, is the preferred method so that there can be modification. But the money's paid over. I don't think the court intended for it to be a $300,000 wedding present for them, and off they go, and not consider the circumstances of her husband and so forth. I don't think there should be any spousal support because of her adultery, which is overwhelming. But I think the matter needs to be remanded because we didn't get to that level of special circumstances or compelling reasons. The trial court didn't explain properly and sufficiently.
Said he wanted her to be able to buy a house,
yes,
and she needed to catch up on her retirement, essentially,
right,
were the two reasons.
Right. And so,
trial judge said,
at the time of the final order was entered in this case, the wife had not received the $300,000 and had already purchased a house. So that argument's gone. And then what the court was trying to do, I think, is to use spousal support in lieu of equitable distribution. I mean, there is specific awards to the wife of two different pension plans from the husband, which she hasn't yet received because the case was on appeal and so forth. But spousal support is not to pump somebody up for retirement. I mean, the trial court acknowledges that this was, even though there was some money, this was a very frugal.
There were quadros that will be entered in or not before us on appeal.
That is correct. And no one's challenging the transfer of the money from the quadros to her and so forth.
Did the husband pay in a timely manner, or was he in and out of court on alleged contempt throughout this divorce? You said it was very contentious.
It was.
Was that the case?
It was.
Did he timely pay his ongoing order of support?
And that was the issue. This husband was paying, the wife was living in the former marital residence, the husband was paying the mortgage, paying the utilities, paying for the two girls.
I understand, but he also had a spousal support obligation, didn't he?
There was a PL award.
Okay. And did he pay that timely?
There was payment. There was at one point a question about whether certain payments had been made. But all of that had been taken care of. The wife was the one who was found in contempt multiple times, and in fact,
But there was an ongoing problem, so it could be that the judge also factored that in when she was looking at the lump sum award.
Well, I mean, it's not in her opinion, it's not in the order, so it wasn't referenced. I mean, I think if the trial judge felt that my client was not paying and therefore had to do the full $300,000 lump sum as the way that would have been explained. I mean, what she did.
But he did have the ability to pay the $300,000 lump sum award.
The trial court did not indicate where that money was going to come from, and an ability to pay that has to be part of the obligation. And nowhere does she say that he does have the ability to pay it or where it's going to come from. I mean, the record is clear that a lot of the money that was originally here in this case was gone by the time the thing was done. The wife went through the $300,000. The husband was paying everything else. One of our appeal issues says that the court gave her a $74,000 that was in one account, even though the account had been fully depleted, the court gave her 100% of that account. Doesn't say anywhere in the opinion why 100% on that one particular account when everything else in this whole case, the judge did 50-50. So, and there was
your,
award
that's your assignment of error too?
Yes. So, you know, in order, this court has made it very clear, I think, Judge Beals, you had a recent decision published where it said that the fact, you've got to have written findings and you've got to lay things out. Nowhere does it talk about why under the 2107.3 factors are we going 100% on this one particular asset when everything else is 50-50. It's a mystery. The same with the issue of the waste, the same with the issue of the gift. There's no single evidence where the wife, where the husband has shown donative intent to give this three-quarter interest back to the marriage. The court doesn't even use the words clear and convincing. I'm not even sure she raised that, even though we noted that that was the correct standard to use. And she just said, well, he's traced it back, but now, because they used it as a vacation home, I'm going to say it was a gift and go. Under Theismann, under the other gift law, that's not the standard. It's a very high standard that the wife has to show of donative intent. Mere retitling, 107.3, says, you know, retitling is not a presumption of gift. There was nothing further, and yet the court went ahead and put this Merritt, Michigan property, the three-quarters interest of at least, back over into White's column. I think that's my time.
Yes, sir. You certainly may go into your rebuttal if you desire, but...
Okay. Well, let me just... So it was... I'll save my time because it was difficult without the cross appeal here than to look at six assignments of errors from the other side, so I'll reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Franzine, and I represent the appellee, Robin Delanoy, in this matter. Without waiving any arguments set forth in our brief, I plan on arguing 4 points this morning. First, in order to prevail on any of the assignments of error, the appellant must show that the trial court abused its discretion in reaching the decision it did. In fact, the record demonstrates as to appellant's assignments abundant factual bases supporting the court's decisions. Second, with regard to the claim of adultery, at no point prior to or during trial of this matter did appellant allege in any pleading adultery by my client with Michael Lipton, the individual that counsel has referred to as the paramour. Even if the appellant had done so, the trial court's conclusion that adultery was not proven was not only supported by the evidence, but given appellee's expressed desire to not have sex prior to the divorce, it was supported by common sense. Moreover,
let me ask you about that, Mr. Franzine, because the adultery issue is, of course, very important in this case with regard to spousal support and even the ED. If we follow your argument here, how can adultery ever be proven in Virginia if you have two parties who concede that they're romantically involved and they're sleeping together so many times that each one said they couldn't remember how many times it was when they were questioned about it? How can it ever be proven if the parties either don't concede that they did, or if there isn't, you know, some sort of, you know, salacious video or something? How can it be proven?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the question then is, will we rely upon the fact finder who has the benefit of weighing the witness's credibility? Will we continue to do that? And believe me, and I'm sure you've seen in the record, a great deal of cross-examination, both of Mr. Rouse, Mr. Lipton, and the appellee, Robin Delanoy. There was an attempt to demonstrate that these circumstances, in fact, led to, inescapably, the conclusion that they had committed adultery. But Ms. Delanoy, as well as the others, Mr. Lipton, and there was, you'll see the evidence with regard to Mr. Rouse is so scant as to be insignificant, but with regard to Mr. Lipton, and I'll correct my fellow counsel here, They didn't sleep naked. The indication was that they were clothed, that they did hold each other for closeness, but that both of them indicated that, and by the way, my client is a Roman Catholic, there were religious reasons for not having sex until divorce. And they both indicated that she had said to him, Mr. Lipton, I want to keep sex out of this relationship. I want to date, but I want to keep sex out of this relationship. Now, the question is that a credible explanation? I believe, Your Honor, that if you had been, Your Honors, if you had been at trial, you had seen the cross-examination and examination of the witness, you would have come to the same conclusion that Judge Higgins did, and that is that that is credible.
So yes, she's certainly the fact finder, and she's observing their testimony, which we cannot do. We have a cold record. But can you cite any case law to me in Virginia where a couple who concedes they're romantically involved and are boyfriend and girlfriend, they've been dating, that they are actually sleeping together and it, absent a medical condition or something, that that isn't generally seen as enough evidence to show adultery, the clear and convincing standard?
I think there are two questions there, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. One is there a case law which says that it's not enough evidence? And I'm not aware that necessarily there is, but I'm not aware that in and of itself that is enough evidence either. That's I understand.
Or even any cases where that's the evidence put forward, because usually you have evidence, even in the Higgins case, you have where this court reversed and said, no, it was adultery. In Higgins, they're not in bed together. There's certainly other, other things where they're scantily clad and so forth, and the daughter testifies, about the men that are in the hives and that sort of thing. But you don't have the situation where they're saying, yes, we've slept together, and we don't even know how many times, we can't tell you.
Well, there are those cases, there's a clear body of case law which talks about situations in which there is either no denial, a claim of Fifth Amendment privilege, or what the court has described as clandestine, clearly suspicious circumstances which are unexplained, in which the individual simply puts forward no explanation.
And your argument here is it's explained.
There is an explanation. Now, in the Higgins case, there was an explanation, but the explanation was, we were in a hotel room having a business meeting, but it was raided, the hotel room was raided by the police and the husband. In that raid, the two individuals were found scantily clad in their underwear alone, and the explanation that was given by the wife was, I was washing my hair. And I think what this court found was that that was an inherently incredible explanation. By the way, I don't believe that case had any testimony by the other party or the paramour. There was no denial there in that case. Here you've got two individuals. And the court had an opportunity to see whether stories matched up, whether there were inconsistencies. Clearly, the two individuals, there was, as in most of these cases, there was an exclusion of witnesses prior to the commencement of evidence. So they didn't have a chance. Mr. Lipton didn't have a chance to hear what my client had said, and vice versa. So there was an opportunity, and Mr. Smith took advantage of that opportunity to see where did it match. Where did it match up?
I don't want to take all of your time on this. I just, since you raised it, I felt I needed to ask that, given the enormous consequences of whether there is adultery here for spousal support in ED.
It is, and I'm glad you did, Your Honor, because it is an important one. Third, with regard to third argument I want to make, is that there's voluminous evidence in the record supporting the court's analysis regarding waste. Much of Appellee's, my client's, expenditures were consumed in this lengthy litigation by legal fees and costs, a total of $175,000 over the course of a couple of years. This was a very long, very bitterly contested matter.
But even if you subtract that $175,000 from the $300,000 she withdrew from the account,
right,
that still, you still got a lot before you get down to the $74,480 that the court found she wasted.
Well, that's true, but keep in mind, Your Honors, that there was, that for reasons which we contested, the court required that there be babysitters for these two teenage daughters. My client had to pay for that. She received no child support. My client had significant counseling expenses for these girls as a consequence of this litigation, the lengthy and bitter nature of the litigation. The evidence is absolutely full of.
So in the pendente lite order, he wasn't ordered to pay for the counseling? Okay. I thought I saw,
well,
somewhere
he was,
there
he was.
Was
ordered to, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
He, however, was reluctant to, and there was always, and continues to this day, to be an unwillingness to pay for it. So my client, in order to make sure that the girls got the counseling that they needed, and one girl in particular who needs a great deal of assistance, in order to make sure that that happened, she paid for it. So those expenses were in that binder, that three-ring binder that we produced, explaining what, where the monies had gone. There were quite a number of just normal living expenses, groceries, additional kind of clothing for the girls and for herself, normal living expenses over the course of 2 years. So yes, we pointed out in our brief, pages 25, 26, I think, of our brief, what that binder, that voluminous three-ring binder, indicates the monies were spent on. And when you get right down to it, actually very little was waste.
Can I ask you about your argument on the Michigan farm?
Yes.
Essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, your argument is that the trial court, and the trial court seemed to say this, is that she thought there was donative intent of the three-quarters share because it was going to be a family vacation spot. Is that right?
I mean, that's what the court said.
If it was to be donative intent, then why wasn't 100% given and not just the three-quarters that he purchased from his siblings? Why not the one-quarter that he inherited from his mother, too?
I think in that particular instance, Your Honor, the way this was, the transaction was consummated, in which Mr. Delanoy inherited a portion and then there was another portion which ultimately was deeded to both of them. He did that intentionally. He did it, now I understand the argument as to why he did it from the appellant standpoint, but he did it, he engineered the execution of that deed.
And he testifies because the local assessor told him that he needed it in both names on the books. The deed needed to be in both names.
That's right.
So is the whole property in both names or just three-quarter share in their names and one-quarter share in his name?
Right now the property, to the best of my knowledge and recollection, Your Honor, it's been a while, I think it's just three-quarters in both names. But it was the intention that only three-quarters be in her name, and the intention was reflected in the deed, and the intention was reflected in the, not only in the intended use of the premises, the farm property, but its actual use. It in fact was used for that purpose, and that distinguishes it somewhat from some of the case law in this area, which talks about donative intent can't really be inferred or implied by simply an intention to do something if there is in fact a consummated intention. In fact, it's something that doesn't in fact take place.
Help me understand why, if they're going to use it as a family vacation, it has to be jointly owned by husband and wife, since this was his family's property. And he inherited a portion of it, and then he bought out his siblings for the other three-quarters of it. why can't they take vacations there and it not just stay in his name?
They can be. They very well can be, but that's not what happened. He could have done that. He chose not to. He chose to engineer it in such a way, and I understand that what he explained at court, at trial, was his rationale. But I think that there is a basis in the record to suggest that the court didn't accept that. Again, we're talking about the fact finder. And as Mr. Smith has pointed out, I think the appendix here is the joint appendix, which does not contain the entire record in the matter, of course, over 6,000 pages.
So but the fact finder can be plainly wrong, of course. And if the fact finder says, okay, there was donative intent because they wanted to take a vacation for 3/4 of it, but not for 1/4 of it, where is the logic, if I may ask that, behind that?
Well, I guess the way you phrase it, Your Honor, there's illogic, but I wouldn't phrase it that way. And I think that that's probably not the way Judge Higgin phrased it. I think, and the reason I think that it's not phrased that way is because it doesn't. You don't need to have an ownership in the other quarter when you're talking about real estate in this case. That Mr. Delanois may very well have wanted to reserve a quarter interest in that property for his own purposes unexpressed. But nevertheless wanted the property to be owned by both parties and, in fact, used by both parties and, in fact, used by their children and, in fact, used by other family members. So, yes, I mean, at first blush, it appears to be somewhat illogical the way you've expressed it, but because of the nature of real property and the nature of this, it's not really, in that sense,
not impossible
divisible.
To do.
Right. It's not, exactly. Your Honor, I see I've only got a few more minutes here. And the other is I want to talk very briefly about lump sum. And the lump sum, Your Honor, I think what Mr. Smith indicates is that there needs to be compelling reasons or some special reasons. That, I don't believe, is the law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I think that what the case law says is that there may be, or that generally there are compelling or specific, but the statutory framework says it can be lump sum or periodic or both, and makes no preference. In this case, Judge Higgins did set forth her specific reasons for calling for a lump sum award, and there was an ability to pay. And I see I've exceeded my time.
Any additional questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. So the Judge Beals, your issue about the tracing, a lot of that was addressed in our reply brief at pages 13 through 15, and it's also in further places in the motions, the post-trial memo and the motions to reconsider, but in the reply brief, I would direct you there for your questions. So basically, in terms of the adultery issue, I mean, these folks were, Mr. Lipton continued to be present. He was there at December 17, 2000.
I just need one question answered,
certainly.
And I'm sure you can tell me right off the top of your head, but granted, we had many boxes of testimony, appendices, and I wondered where I saw the motion, and I saw for leave of court to file the amended counterclaim. I saw the answer to the amended counterclaim, but I couldn't find an order. Did I just overlook that, or can you point me to where that is?
The order granting leave?
Yes, sir.
Oh.
You're assuring me that it's there?
Yes, I mean, it was basically, it came in, I think, the day before the trial. We had found this evidence about, not just about Mr. Rouse, additional evidence about Mr. Rouse that we moved to amend. The court granted that motion. We did file an amended counterclaim. Mr. Franzine, on behalf of the wife, filed an answer on that.
Right. I saw the motions. I just never saw a court order incorporating in the judges, which I assumed that she had granted your motion, or otherwise counsel would not have answered.
Right.
But I couldn't find the order, and I thought perhaps I just overlooked it in the volume of material that we had.
I'm not sure if, off the top of my head, if there was indeed a separate order specific to that point.
If there wasn't an order, let's just travel down that road just for a moment. If there wasn't an order, then what would that, assuming that perhaps there might not be, if there's not one, then what does that do for the amended counterclaim in reference to the allegations of adultery?
So the transcript is clear, and you have the full transcript of this case where the whole issue of requesting the leave to amend was fully addressed.
was granted on the record by the trial court. Obviously, Mr. Franzine, on behalf of the wife, would not have filed an answer. There's nowhere in there that says, you know, the court didn't give me permission to file that. He wasn't happy that the court did that, but I mean, neither of us have any dispute
I'm not suggesting.
And I'll go back and look at the record, and this, as I indicated, the record was prepared here by a deputy clerk who had never done a record before, and so there was an additional, I think the letter opinion, for instance, didn't make it over the first time and had to be sent over, but I'll look and see, but there's no dispute, it's in the transcript that the court granted that request, and that was not.
Is that encompassed in the order, the initial order of the court that they granted that leave?
I think
what you're indicating?
I think it's referenced, Your Honor, in, let's see, that would be maybe, let me look at this, page 61 of the appendix.
I just wanted to bring up that issue. I don't want to get you off track.
Yeah, well, I think
plenty of issues to deal with here, so.
I believe in our actual amended counterclaim, it references that upon the hearing held and upon the court granting leave, and it may have been encapsulated there. But basically, Mr. Lipton was around at the December 17, 2012 hearing. The court was putting restrictions on him. April 19, 2013 was when the hearing was December. April 13, they had the hearing restrictions on him. December 6, the final order entered. He's present. I mean, basically, these people acknowledge romantic relationship. There's opportunity, there's disposition, there's gifts, there's travel, there's physical displays of affection. But for an admission saying, yes, we engage in intercourse, we have everything here. We have adultery found on so much lower threshold. And basically, if the court does not find adultery here, then it's basically setting up the thing saying, unless the parties will acknowledge that they had intercourse, then we can't find it. I mean, no one was hiding this romantic relationship. This wasn't, they acknowledged it. They were hand in hand. Mr. Lipton acknowledged it as well. That we're boyfriend, girlfriend, and they didn't see any problem with it. Yeah, we took trips together. Yes, we slept in the same bed. Oh, did we have sex? No, we did not have sexual relations. So there you go. The credibility of the parties
wouldn't be saying, however, that the court couldn't do that.
No,
I mean, that's a credibility determination, isn't it? And all we're saying is we can't do it. That's a fact finder determination. Wouldn't that be what we were saying? Not another trial court couldn't. Another trial court on these same facts could have reached a different conclusion.
It is a discretionary call, and we've basically said that the court abuses discretion in doing that. And I've cited in my brief, there's ample authority for where this court has said, trial court, abuse. You went over the thing, we're finding adultery. You don't have to hit us over the head with it. We see it. And then for the gift thing, exactly. I mean, there has to be, the burden is on the wife to show the donative intent of the husband. She doesn't even know how the property was acquired. The titling means nothing under 2107.3. The law is clear on that. She says, I mean, that would be saying, if I let you use my vehicle, use means that you own my vehicle now. That's not the law of the Commonwealth.
You need to be winding down.
Sir. So I think I've addressed the questions of the court. I know it's a big case. Thank you for your consideration.
Were there any other questions from the court?
No further questions.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.